Oh, thanks so much. That's great. Wow, that's super. Thanks so much for the introduction. Let's see. What I want to do today indeed is talk about the very first things in the universe. It sounds kind of bizarre, but you know, we all heard about the Big Bang, and the universe only has a certain age. It's only 14 billion years old. 13.7, we think, is our best number right now. And you know, it sort of struck me that, well, if the universe, you know, has a finite age, then it's quite obvious that there is such a thing, like the very first thing. You know, in the old days, you know, Einstein was mocking about with his equations to make a static universe, because he, back then, you know, still thought the nicest way to think about the universe is one that's lived forever, and he was trying to get that into his equations, and sort of, you know, conceptually it would have been interesting. Of course, we now know that's not true. The universe is expanding, and as a consequence, it used to be, typical distances in the universe used to be much smaller in the past, and so there actually was a beginning to it. And we even know this age of about 14 billion years, and so when I first sort of came across this question, I was actually upset with myself. Like, why did I never think of this in the first place, you know? It's such an obvious question. I mean, you know, I already knew that the universe only had a finite age. I should have been wondering, you know, since I'm like 3 years old, what is the very first thing in the universe? Instead, I only started when I was 23 or so. But, you know, what I'm going to try to walk you through is, you know, after sharing a few sort of exciting news in cosmology in general, and give us all a sort of a feel of what our place in the universe looks like, and sort of actually look at observed data and go out, explore what our immediate surroundings look like, only out to a few hundred million light years. Okay, so we're not going to go that far today. You'll see there's still plenty of things in there. But then I just want to sort of talk about the concept that if you take a good telescope today, and you stare out on the night sky, and you look for the tiniest little faint dots, you know, that some of them that we see, their light, in fact, started 12.7, 12.8 billion years ago, traveling towards us, and since then has been traveling in a straight line until our detectors hit it. So in some sense, we have a time machine with any telescope. You know, as you look out to further and further distances, light took a finite amount of time to get to us, so it's great. All you need is a telescope, you've got a time machine. And we can't quite go there, and it doesn't work like in Hollywood, but but at least it's something we all can do in our backyard. Now, but in particular, I want to highlight what, you know, in popular press has been dubbed the baby pictures of the universe. In fact, the earliest direct observational evidence we have of what the universe looked like at a time when it was only 400,000 years old. Okay, I've been talking about billions of years. Here, I'm talking about when the universe was 400,000 years old, it had a whole bunch of radiation in it. At that time, all the radiation started to go in a straight line, and when we see it today with our detectors, we in fact pick up photons or radiation back from way back when. So there's this very bizarre epoch in the universe. Okay. Speak up a little here. So if you're, there's this bizarre fact about the universe that we know what it looked like when it was 400,000 years old, then we know long nothing, and then we see things when it was about a billion years old, and we see some faint little red dots that we can tell, but this whole first billion years, we actually don't know observationally. We cannot, with our best telescopes today, actually see anything. It's just too dim. We still think there was something back there, but we can't quite see it yet. That period has been dubbed the Dark Ages. And I just hope that it turns out that they're only not so bright ages. So when we come along with the next telescopes, bigger and better, and some from space, the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, that we'll actually be able to probe directly some of these more fainter things really far back. But then I really want to launch into eventually just talking about, if you know what the universe looked like way back then, and you know the laws of physics, you know, what do we need in observation? We should be able to predict exactly what happens given those initial conditions and knowing laws of physics. And that's sort of what I've been obsessing about over the last 10, 15 years. I want to share some of those findings with you. And then at the end, I'd like to wrap up and try to give you a few sort of thoughts of why one should take astrophysics and sort of these aspects of star formation actually very personal. We'll go there. Connects to all of it. Okay, so that's our place in the universe. I am a theorist, but you know, I do go out and look at the night sky. I know about three constellations. It's, you know, over the years it is getting better. I think I'm up to 10 almost already. But this is a very popular one. That's Orion. If you've ever seen Man in Black, that's Orion's belt. He has a sword hanging from it. That's actually his elbow. That's the head. And, you know, there's some bear over here that he's shooting. So he's sort of standing there. He holds a bow and sword. Anyway, very macho on this guy. Anyway, so you see this star is a little redder than the rest. When we put this pictures together, it's actually every single dot on here is an observed star. We know the exact position to within a few percent. In three dimensions, where these stars are, we know exactly how bright they are, we know their color, we also have other information about these stars. It's all observed. So this is not just a picture, this is actually taking all the positions of the stars, their luminosity sizes, put them in three dimensions, and then use the computer to fly towards them. So this whole hazy band back here, of course, is the Milky Way. All the dark patches are cold molecular clouds. It's actually full of dust. It's just, you know, like my student apartment, which it was hard to look through. And all the hazy things you see here is just a myriad of stars that we have in the Milky Way galaxy, where you don't see them individually anymore. They just appear like a haze because it's just so many of them behind it. But these clouds are close to us, and they sort of block the view if we look with our eyes. If we look in other wavelengths, we still can see quite a whole bunch of things. Now let me do something fun that you shouldn't try at home. So we're going to fly towards Orion. First thing you notice already, there goes the shoulder. The head's already gone. Some of the legs are off. And so that's sort of the key observation right away when you couldn't do this in three dimensions is the constellations are pure chance projections on the sky. Right? They look to us like they make some little figure, but in reality, there's nothing to it. It's not a structure. It's not anything to it. There's just some stars that are fairly dim, really close to us, and other stars that are quite bright, but much further away that make this up. And there's some remarkable things about stars, that there are stars that are 100,000 times brighter than our sun. And there's stars that are much, much dimmer yet. So the range of, for you know, what is a star, how bright it can vary enormously. And so it all has to do with how much mass they have. So the ones that are more massive are kind of like the rock stars. They live fast, die young. So they go through their fuel very rapidly. And so they shine very brightly for this just a few million years. Our sun does this a bit more economically, sticks around for about 10 billion years. That's nice, another 5 billion years to go. And so that's what makes up these constellations. So you can have stars of very much different intrinsic brightness, luminosity, how much energy they put out per time. And that's why, you know, it's easy to confuse that, you know, you get such a wide range and you sort of see these chance projections on the sky. If all the stars had the same luminosity, then the things that, you know, sort of look more or less the same brightness would all be at the same location. But that's sort of the physical fact that makes this all different. Okay, but you already see something a little sort of hazy back here, and actually on a really good night, you can sort of see this hazy spot with your naked eye. That's Orion Nebula, and that's at about a good 1,200 light years from us. So one thing you notice when we do this flying is that we're indeed flying much faster than the speed of light, which of course wouldn't work if we're in a spaceship. Nevertheless, here that's actually a nursery of where new stars are being formed. And so all these bright, new massive stars are lighting up all the gas around it out of which they form. That's the Horsehead Nebula. Another example of sort of a reflection nebula where bright stars illuminate the gas and you sort of see the gases around it. Here we're just flying around. That's a Rosette Nebula. There's another region where you have massive star formation. Those are tens of thousands of stars actually inside of here that light up all the gases around it. The red is a particular line of hydrogen, and hydrogen is the most abundant atom in the universe. As we keep flying, there's another fun guy over here. That's the Crab Nebula. That's actually the remnant of a star that exploded a couple kiloparsecs away. That's a few thousand light years. And you see something blinking in there. In reality, it blinks a lot faster. It's actually a pulsar. So when the star exploded, it left behind a neutron star that's actually spinning around its axis 1,000 times a second. So you have to think, you know, think of something, you know, that's as massive as the sun, as big as Santa Barbara, and it's turning around 1,000 times a second. Kind of cool. But now I went really fast. Let me just stop here real quick. So now, as we sort of look out on this scale, actually, as we're flying out of the galaxy, this part is the only part of the movie that's completely made up. Okay, we have absolutely no idea, well, not quite no idea, but we really don't have a picture of our own Milky Way galaxy from the top down. Okay, so we're about, you know, a good million light years or so, a few hundred thousand light years away from the Milky Way right now, and we're looking back at it. Now, we've never seen this. No, there was no spacecraft that ever, you know, the best spacecraft that we, the furthest out we ever managed, just made it out of the solar system. All the things we've looked at, you know, started already further away than sort of Jupiter or Pluto and way out there. So, okay, this part we don't know for sure. We chose a nice galaxy that actually lines up with its spiral arms, where we know the spiral arms in our galaxy are, but it's actually a picture of another galaxy, not the Milky Way itself. Now, however, every single other dot here is, in fact, the location and the image of an observed galaxy with our best distance estimator. So this would be the Large Magellanic Cloud. That's the Small Magellanic Cloud. So if you, you know, ever visited the southern hemisphere, the southern night sky, you actually see them with your naked eye. But, you know, going to Brazil is really nice for this. They very close. These are two galaxies that are just falling into the Milky Way. Okay, you see all these other little tiny dots around here. They're small. We call them dwarf galaxies. So our galaxy has about 100 billion stars in it. These have sort of. We've even found some now that only have tens of thousands of stars. They're just being discovered. In fact, the smallest ones of them, the ones more traditional ones we know, they have sort of order billion stars in them. But much smaller than the Milky Way, and they tend to hang out around bigger galaxies. We call that clustered. Now, as we fly around, there's our sister galaxy coming into view. That's the Andromeda galaxy. Very exciting. It's the farthest thing you can see with your naked eye. It's just a little tiny hazy spot. It's a couple million light years away. That's a Triangulum, massive star-forming region here, which is flying through. But this Andromeda galaxy is on the way to collide with the Milky Way. Okay, a few billion years from now, the Milky Way and Andromeda would just become one galaxy. Be nice. I mean, imagine 4 billion years from now, you're an astronomer, you're going out in the at night. There's 200 billion stars right in front of you. It's fantastic. We have quite good constraints, but they're already on the way of going. They will collide. They will do a turn out, but they are already bound, so they will come back together. So there's gonna be tidal tails. It's gonna be really spectacular to be an astronomer then. So you don't want to study too much about stars already, because you know you can do it really well. Just a joke. But what we noticed actually when we do this is that you're. Let me see if I can fly this back a little bit. One thing you know is every single dot now is a galaxy. All of them more or less the size of the Milky Way. Okay, we're hundreds of millions of light years away from where we're used to. And as you look at these structures, you see sort of, there's sort of a large scale organization. These galaxies are just like, they don't distribute randomly throughout space. there is some more sheet-like structures and sort of filamentary, sort of more sort of long tube type thing. And then there's a virgo cluster, sort of a more round distribution of galaxies. There's a couple thousand galaxies going around each other. Okay, so we're used to sort of going around the sun. The sun goes around the center of the Milky Way. It takes about 250 million years or so to get around. Then we talk about our galaxy flying into another galaxy in a few billion years. These galaxies, in fact, are in such dense regions that you have thousands of galaxies going around each other. We call them clusters of galaxies. Most spectacular object. Most galaxies, however, are not in these clusters. Most galaxies actually live in groups like our local group, so where you have a few spiral galaxies hang out together, like Andromeda, Milky Way. Lots of interesting things here. All the colors, all the images are correct. You see this nice little spiral guy. And the big fellow coming up sits right in the middle. That's M87. And you see this little faint thing sticking out, this blue thing. It's actually because it has a billion solar mass black hole sitting in the center of this galaxy that's throwing out material at over 99% the speed of light. Okay, it's so you can imagine when you're in the middle of a galaxy cluster, so there's 1,000 galaxies going around each other, trying to anyway. You know, when you're in the center of that, you know, it's like going downtown. You really get traffic jammed. So there's lots of galaxies that collide in the center. So it's often that we find in the centers of galaxies the largest galaxies we can find anywhere. And so they do look different in many ways. They're very round, they're very old, they have thousands of globular clusters, and I explain that to you, what that is. They have the biggest black holes that we can find anywhere in the universe. That just sort of takes this home a little bit, this sort of the large scale structure of the universe. It's you know, they're structural on all scales. Only when we go out to sort of a billion light year scale and look at the universe from that scale, does it seem that it's actually nice and smooth. But all the way up to a few hundred million light years scales, there's actually still sort of, you know, more sheets and filaments of alignments of galaxies. On the very large scale, the universe is homogeneous and isotropic as far as we can tell. It's just on these other scales we can probe it isn't. Very exciting. So now you have to think about thus theoretical cosmologists, you know, we're trying to understand how all structure in the universe comes about. We're trying to understand how you had a Big Bang and then eventually made all this structure. And we're kind of crazy sometimes. We like to understand how much dust there is, how much sort of black, dark lanes there are, how many blue stars, how many red stars, how many stars that are a billion years old, how many stars that are 5 billion years old. You know, how do these individual supernovae work? We really try to put all this information together to build up a coherent story, you know, and I mean, that's based in physical theory of how you went from a simple, smooth universe to begin with, I'll show you why we think that's true, to all what we see in this movie. So of course it's a little bit crazy, but you know, I think of it as job security. All right. Now, you know, our galaxy is actually quite fun. So what I told you is what we looked at was made up. This is a real view of what our galaxy looks like in near-infrared light. So that would be the light that you'd have in night vision goggles. You can see in a bit further. So the lanes that we saw before in the optical, you know, where we had all the dark patches, now using more infrared light, we can actually penetrate. And it looks like, you know, sort of the egg sunny side up. You've got, and that's actually what's really remarkable about galaxies in general. They are about 100 times wider than they are high. These disk galaxies are extraordinarily thin, but they have some sort of bulgy part in the middle that bulges out. We call it the bulge. And the scales here is, sorry for keeping these astronomer type units, multiply by 3, and that's a kilo. So if I multiply by 3, I get about 100, say, 1,000 light years. So about 100,000 light years is this scale across. And our sun lives out about 24,000 light years from the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. And that's sort of very far. So even though we're going at 200 kilometers a second, which is actually quite rapid, So, you know, I could get back to Stanford in a couple seconds, maybe a little longer, three, at that speed. It still takes 250 million years for the sun to get around the center of the Milky Way to do this. There's another few fun things. In the halo of the galaxy, you have all these globular clusters. These are clusters of stars. Roughly, think about a million suns that all go around each other. Okay? They are as big as the distance from us to the nearest star. Okay? So between us and the nearest star, well, you know, there's two stars. In these globular star clusters, you would have a million. Okay? So the night sky would be very bright. Okay, right? It's like all the starlight would be a million times what you're used to. So very different type systems and very mysterious. We still have very little understanding of how they come about. But when we look, they turn out to be quite ancient. And I'll show you a close-up in a second. Let me just make one more point, and it already came up between the distinction of what we see when we look with our naked eye compared to the near-infrared. There's all these different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum that we can look at our own galaxy. And we've got everything from very long wavelengths, sort of radio, what you use, you know, in particular actually with television sets and cell phones, to particular lines that are giving off only by hydrogen, many different types of the infrared. There's a lot of dust that actually radiates in this. And then the optical one is the one we're used to, but also much more energetic things come towards us in X-rays and, you know, gamma rays, which is just very energetic things coming. You know, all these types of radiation is produced everywhere in the Milky Way. And so you'd think, you know, if the astronomer is just sitting there and only studying the pretty pictures of the night sky, it's not like that anymore. Like, we turn every single detector we have at the universe, and we can study things that have to do with extraordinarily high energies, the X-rays and gamma rays, but also very moderate energies that sort of more like your cell phone or your television would do, radios. And so that's, of course, all the power that we have, and that's why in the past decades we learned so much new things about the universe, because we have these new detectors. Okay, let me also do another quick piece of advice. Never fight gravity. Gravity is an awful nemesis because it just doesn't stop. You can do what you want, it will not stop trying to crush you. Now, that was the collision we already talked about. That was the Milky Way, and that's the Andromeda Galaxy, and that's what we think in a computer model, what it's going to look like. You will have all these sort of tidal tails, and our sun might sit out here for a while, so, you know, we get a nice view over here. But the whole thing will eventually collapse together and make one of those round or elliptical type galaxies. Now, the trouble with gravity is it keeps pulling. And so our sun is doing a great job. It's just acting against it. It's really doing its very best. But the only way it can sustain itself, of like staying stable, is that it started taking some of the hydrogen in its center, and through nuclear fusion turns the hydrogen into helium. And there's a hydrogen bomb in the center of the sun that produces enough energy to hold off gravity. But the big mistake, of course, that the sun is making is it's giving off light, which, you know, is great for us. No life on Earth without the light from the sun. But the trouble is it's losing energy by giving off all this light. And so eventually, gravity will always win. And sort of that's sort of a dominant factor actually at every scale in the universe, in particular the larger scales, only the gravitational force is really what dominates everything. Why galaxies fall together, what holds stars together, what eventually leads to making such crazy things like black holes, where not even light can escape anymore, this drag of gravity. Anyway, so it's useful advice to not fight gravity at home. We always take the chance when we can do something useful. Now, that's just a close-up of one of these globular star clusters. There's close to 200 in our Milky Way, and many of them appear to be almost as old as the universe. In fact, in sort of the 60s, when people first learned how to age date, you know, how old stars can be, they found out they're older than the universe. And that was kind of a trouble, because how'd you go about that? Well, it turns out, you know, people then finally revised, you know, this age dating wasn't that accurate. They realized they're a little bit younger. At the same time, the universe now turned out to be 2.5 times older. And so as the measurements got better, it got a little bit more consistent. However, as far as we can tell, quite a number of these were still formed very early on. As our age dating, unfortunately, is only accurate to within 1 billion years, maybe two. You know, I'm already being generous. So it means somewhere in the first 2 to 3 billion years of the universe, we had to make objects like this. Star clusters where you made 1 million stars in the distance from us to the nearest star. That's right. And it's quite remarkable that some of the biggest galaxies we see have thousands of them. So an M87, I think, is like 3,000 globular clusters, and a whole population. So then there's always an old one and a newer one. So lots of interesting things about it, but you know, theories are actually not particularly good on them yet. So that already gives us a glimpse very close by that something happened fairly early in the universe. Okay, if we now do some little crazy thing, we take the best telescope we have, and we stare at one spot on the sky for as long as anybody will allow us. So in this particular case, you know, take the Hubble Space Telescope. That's actually an astronaut right here working on fixing it. That's the shuttle down here, and it's sort of docked, and it's on a repair mission. We're excited that this is going to happen again very soon to get upgrades of the cameras for the Hubble Space Telescope. But if you now just take it, and for 400 orbits as it goes around the Earth, always keep staring at a tiny, tiny little part of the sky, you get this image. And that was sort of the deepest image that we have of the sky. That's an ultra deep field. And you know, when you do this the first time, you look at an image like this, you say, oh, that's very nice. You know, there's all these galaxies, that's very pretty. You know, and they looked at a very particularly dark spot in the sky where they knew there wasn't a very bright thing in front of them. And you say, oh, that's all very nice. But now, of course, the cosmologists are kind of funny that way. All we do is we go through and then we look for the tiniest red little splodges. So this one is already too bright. You don't even worry about that. You want something that's tiny, tiny little and red. Why red? It's because the universe is expanding. And the further things are away, the faster they are expanding. And that's just exactly what you know from your, you know, when you have an ambulance driving by, as it comes to you, it goes wee, wee, wee. And then as it drives away, it goes whir, 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 whir. And that's exactly how this works in the universe. As galaxies move away from us, their wavelengths get whir, whir, whir. They sort of get longer, so they get redder. And usually when you look at an image, red is a good sign that it has a high probability of being something really far away, moving very fast away from us. Now, so we'll get all this great data, and then we look for these tiniest, really red splotches, and we get most excited about them. Because that's when we get information about the universe when it was very young. And indeed, some of the little pixels in here actually contain light that has been traveling 12.7 billion years before it hit the camera on HST. And it's really, actually, there's a whole bunch in here. But you know, I couldn't point them out anymore. I think actually this one. But see, so this is a little red blotch there. But yeah, they don't look very exciting once you actually do the blow up of it, because you only see it in one band. But you know, we get more and more information on them. Now, of course, the very best baby pictures you can take in sort of the same spirit is actually looking for radiation that's left over from the Big Bang. And there's some beautiful stories to be told of how, you know, sort of recent Nobel, sort of Penzias and Wilson have got this Nobel Prize in 78 for a discovery they made in the early to mid 60s of radiation that for them just seemed some nuisance because they were pointing this antenna around and everywhere they pointed, they always had this noise. Only when they pointed it at Earth was it quiet. Okay, so that's, but they couldn't figure out what's wrong with their detector. And there's these wonderful anecdotes, them going in, cleaning out pigeon remnants, I guess you would say. And you know, that noise persisted. And what they measured is sort of, that's a map of the sky. So where this direction up here would be coming from the North Galactic Pole. So there's something from above the disk of the galaxy down. the central point would be looking towards the center of our Milky Way. The point down here would be looking down. And these two points back here are actually the same. So it's just like a world map. If you want, normally you sort of look at a globe and you stretch out a map like this. This is the same idea, but just done for the sky. Now, very boring, it's just one flat color. So what they found is that the radiation that they saw seemed to be exactly the same no matter which direction they looked. It was very strange. There, however, were some predictions that for the Big Bang, for a hot beginning of the universe, you would have had radiation like this left over. And the remarkable thing is that all of us actually did the observation. So when you have an old television set and all the static in it, about 1% of it is actually caused by this cosmic background radiation. So, you know, in some sense, we've all seen it on our own sort of detector. So in some sense, it tells you there's actually nothing difficult about detecting it. Because if any old television set already picks up some of that signal, you know, it's not so hard to build good experiments that can study this in much greater detail. Now, of course, that's exactly what happened in sort of the early to mid-90s. There was the COBE satellite flying, and last year's Nobel Prize actually went to two of the main people designing the instrument that made much more precision measurements of this radiation over the sky. And the key thing what they found is that, yes, it's perfectly uniform, but there's tiny little changes in some directions. There's a few regions that are slightly warmer than other regions. And that's a very key aspect that actually, let me do this here. I was sort of thinking, because we already talked about that when gravity, once it has something to hold on to, it will always try to contract it further. And so if we see that radiation left over from the Big Bang, some regions were slightly hotter, that tells us that some of the regions were in fact somewhat denser. So if there's a little bit more material in one region, then gravity will take over. Now if the universe were completely smooth, gravity just can't win. Everything's tugging on everything the same way. If some regions are slightly denser to begin with, they will contract further and further and further. And so gravity, again, will win. And that's, of course, an absolutely marvelous thing for us to realize that all the structure we see, all the galaxies, galaxy clusters, and sort of all that allows for us to come into being actually relied very sensitively on having had slight inhomogeneities early on. And it was quite remarkable when it was actually then finally discovered. And the way you want to think about this is perhaps sort of like when you have clouds on the sky, and radiation, in some sense, right, it comes from the sun, and then you have the radiation sort of bounces around off the cloud, and all you see when you look up is sort of the bottom of the cloud, right? So when the radiation that scattered sort of through the cloud leaves the cloud, it just comes to you in a straight line. And so you nicely sort of see the bottom side of the cloud. But that's exactly the picture we have of how this worked in the universe. That the universe was very dense early on, it was very hot, and you had all the radiation that was in it was just scattering around. But at some point, as the universe became, during the expansion, it became cold, and it became neutral, sort of clear. And all the photons that are coming out of this fog are now going in straight lines towards our detectors. And so it's really marvelous. So for 13.7 billion years, photons go straight, and we get direct information of what the universe looked like back then, sort of the surface of the cloud, if you want. Well, let me just see whether I can draw this one here. Actually.
Thank you.
It's true. Santa Barbara is not expanding. But, you know, that's sort of always this sort of key concept of, you know, what exactly does this mean? So, you know, the typical distances between galaxies are indeed growing. But for us, you know, that we go around the sun, you know, space itself seems to be expanding. But us, our orbit around the sun is fixed. We're not, you know, we're not changing. We're not expanding. The galaxy's not getting bigger. And, you know, Woody Allen tells this much better than anyone could do. Now, so our latest satellite that's measuring this baby pictures of the universe is the WMAP satellite, and it made this marvelous image where, again, in fact, sort of these different spots of the red would correspond to warmer and the blue to colder spots on this background sky. And, you know, we really can study now the structure of what the universe looked like back then. And so we see much smaller scale, much better map. And we know how many regions were how much denser than other regions. Stephen Hawking was very excited about this and hailed it like the greatest discovery of mankind, just because of that link, that without those fluctuations, would we have not found them? We would have not been able to understand how structure would have evolved at all, and how would we come about. And they found it at exactly the right level. So it's a beautiful, consistent picture by now. And for some reason, he managed to get his initials into this map. I have no idea how he did this. It's something very bizarre, of course, with your brain. Like, you know, you would have never noticed it, and now every single time you look at it, you cannot avoid it. And so, brains. So this is actually included with the emission of our own galaxy. And this is a clean map. So they have many different channels, and from that they can distinguish the radiation that left over from the Big Bang versus the radiation that comes from nearby. And you see that even spots up here, even without cleaning, they already see the signal. So, you know, they're very confident about a number of the statements. Now, so we've got this amazing picture, the universe 13.7 billion years old. It started out with only hydrogen and helium for all the things we know, sort of the gaseous part, sort of atoms. So there was no carbon, no oxygen, no silicon, only hydrogen, helium. Then, you know, in this sort of pie diagram, there is a whole bunch of material that we can infer directly from observations. Has to be there. We see its gravity. We just call it dark matter because at a fundamental level, we actually don't know what that is. And I'm sure you might have heard a bunch of lectures about this here already. Even more mysterious, of course, in the past 10 years, it became apparent that the universe started accelerating. You know, not in the last 10 years, but in the last 10 years, we figured it out, it started accelerating. In fact, it was in the last 10 billion years, 8 billion years, that it started accelerating. And the most bizarre thing about this is it's very easy to understand, okay, if it's initially expanding, that it'll slow down. It's easy to understand because there's gravity, you know, and there's stuff in the universe, and it weighs something, and things won't want to fly away. They try to attract each other, so you want it to, totally natural for it to slow down. But what caused it to speed up about 8 billion years ago, we literally have no idea. Okay, I shouldn't say it like that. We have many. We have many proposals. All right, and so, you know, there's certainly arguments we could make about this. And, you know, right, it's sort of the biggest mystery in physics today. I think that's where we all, or sort of many people agree on, and want to try to figure this out in detail. Now, you know, where there's less sort of an argument about is that when we look back, we have the data directly. What we see is that regions, some regions of the universe are a little denser than the rest by as much as 1%. Okay, and those, through gravity, will manage to actually collapse into early structures early on. So the way I think about this, I look at it, I say, okay, I know how warm the universe was from this map. I also know the distribution of matter, how dense it was in this region versus this region, and the whole statistics of it. You know, there's some regions where you have more sort of warm spots. There's other regions where you have more sort of coldish regions. And the overall statistics of this distribution, I actually know. So now all I need to know is my physical laws, right? And so I need gravity, I need to know how gases move, so hydrodynamics, so how the air flows in this room. Those are actually fairly simple equations that just have to do how mass, momentum, and energy is conserved in something that moves. Okay. Now there's a little bit more to it. There is chemistry. Because if my gas makes the same mistake as our sun does, that it gives off radiation, then gravity will always win. Gravity will always pull things together as long as something's radiating. Now, for that, I need to worry about which molecules do I have, which atoms are being excited, giving off light. And so I have to solve for all these quantities. I solve for the abundances of things. I solve for the hydrodynamics. I solve for the gravity. And worry about which radiation is coming out. And you tell you're done. I know, you know, what to start from. I see directly in the observations, evolve it forward, see what comes out. The only tricky bit, of course, is that the range of scales involved. We already realized that our sun is a trillion times smaller than the Milky Way. I mean, a trillion times is a lot smaller. So when the Andromeda and the Milky Way galaxies run into each other, no two stars will hit. Okay? It's actually, galaxies on pictures, they always look so smooth and, you know, like they're all filled. Well, it's because our detectors aren't good enough. We don't have enough pixels, you know, megapixels in your camera to actually distinguish all the different stars. With a better camera, it would all become just pure space and just very rare dots. So you take two galaxies with 100 billion stars, throw them at each other, no two stars will even come close. Okay, so unlikely. Now, so it's a question of scale that sort of made this difficult. And so we spent quite a bit of time sort of working out numerical algorithms that can actually do this. And so this quick fly through here, there's a fly-in that we saw, captured already 10 orders of magnitude, where we zoomed out from a large scale onto the scale of one single protostar. And the big mystery we were after when we sort of first started this was, it's like, what happens with these very first objects? What many people agreed on for over, you know, since the late 60s, was that the very first object that would form in a region that's a few hundred light years across, has a million times the mass of the sun, but what they could not agree on, what it will turn into. The first crowd, of course, said, the late 60s, right? They said it's globular clusters because they're older than the universe. So the best thing we can do is make the very first thing in the universe. And so, you know, great theory. Actually, amazing paper by Beebles and Dickey that should have been, you know, also played a big role in the story about the cosmic microwave background radiation. However, there's this whole other school that says, oh, no. The whole thing will all go into one supermassive black hole. Okay? This has 10 to the 6 solar masses, and this is 10 to the 6 solar masses of individual stars. In fact, you know, there were, you know, many tens, close to 100 papers, actually arguing everything in between, and also lower, in the sense, no, it's a cluster of little brown dwarfs, sort of stars that would still be around today, you know, wouldn't die. We had some that actually made MACHOs, a sort of a funny acronym, when people were looking for what the dark matter now in Milky Way might be like. They said, early objects could have made that. And the trouble, of course, was they all knew what it started from. And so they knew the basic physics of what cools the gas and how gas moves together. But since it's sort of a coupling of how the gravity works, how the gas moves, how the chemistry works, how the radiation comes out, and how that interplay of the gas radiating and gravity pulling it together, the gas radiating again, gravity pulling, that was the tricky part to sort of distinguish. All they knew is, you know, we had this object, you know, but does it break up or not? You just can't do on an envelope. It's not something you can, with analytic theory, sort of, you know, in your tradition, do up in issue. And that's why there's big advances in larger supercomputers today in having numerical methods that actually accurately can model these equations is a huge breakthrough for us in also trying to understand any of these physics where many different physical mechanisms couple. Okay. And so we did it. It got kind of fun while doing this. There's a movie we did for Discovery Channel a few years ago where now here, the lighter the color, the higher the density. What is shown is sort of on a 1,000 light year scale is only the gas, only the hydrogen helium material that you see makes these little balls. These little balls are about 10,000 to 100,000 times the mass of our sun, and gravity keeps pulling them together. Right? As they run into each other, all the kinetic energy, all the sort of motion they have, also gets all converted into heat, but also into turbulence. So you see all this material that's moving around, and now we're actually flying into one that's a million times the mass of our sun, and we're flying deep inside of it, and just continue this zooming and zooming to see the structures deep within it. There are these structures that become rounder. It's a particular phase where the molecular hydrogen cooling is very slow, so it's a little bit like the sun. The gravity pulls it together, but pressure manages to have a little bit of time pushing back. As we get in much further, however, you get a protostar with more of a disc-like thing around it, something that's slightly rotating. We actually think of our solar system forming similar to this in the sense that there would be a sun in the middle and a disc around it. In our solar system, however, we would have dust and rock, and they would assemble and actually be able to make some planets in here that would now, you know, stick around and go around it. There was no dust in the early universe, and you notice it was for Discovery Channel, so I have to apologize here because we skipped 3 million years. So, you know, in this movie, the star just exploded. That was a supernova, this last bit. And it's, you know, it looks a little bit like anime, I guess. That's right, that's the 3 million years we skipped. And the trouble was that we can model this very well as sort of the star, just loses energy to the radiation, and it collapses further, and gravity pulls it together. But then there's this phase when the star is only 10 Jupiter masses, and it then accretes in 100,000 years all the rest of its mass. And it grows up to about 100 solar masses. And then we can already gauge from the results that we see. But these 100,000 years are very difficult to model, because the time scale on the protostars of what happens on it is sort of more a second time scale. You want to do it for 100,000 years. So even, you know, if I had the fastest computer, I would do all these calculations, I'm still not sure I would trust the result, because I'm adding up lots and lots of error that could potentially cause trouble. So we need new numerical techniques, in fact, to make progress in that way. And so I spent many, many years on improving on this. And sort of the one thing I did manage was to actually learn how to do when the star starts shining and its radiation, which is very bright in the UV, is a million times the luminosity of our sun. It's all, you know, very hard UV, so we wouldn't want to be there. It's like big sunburn trouble. This one, it actually has an enormous impact on all the gases around it, because it heats all the material to 10,000 degrees around it, which will expel, just the pressure will expel all the material behind it. Let me just show this movie again, because that's a depiction actually of what happens when you now have a star that sort of sits in this filamentary phase where all these clumps were falling together. So again, about a good 1,000 light years across, you've got the star as it's shining, but now it didn't skip the few million years. Now we are 200,000 years out. You sort of see how its radiation travels out, and it lights up all the material around it. So blue here means hot, red is cold. That's for astronomers, you know, that's how we like to think about it. That was a supernova that went off right in here. And what you see now is all the gas over here was actually the gas that was expelled by the star, just from the radiation alone. And now the supernova starts catching up to this material, and this corrugated surface is all the material that came out from the stellar explosion mixing in. That's already heavy elements. Every single one of you has a few atoms in yourself that did this. Actually, for these first stars, it's about only your pinky, sort of in their mass scale. But it's a whole bunch of them that contributed to every single one of us. I'll say more about that later. This, you know, I mean, it all sounds a little bit crazy, like he's just making it up on his computer. But we see many of these examples in our own galaxy. So this star has a 330,000 times the luminosity of our sun. And this gas was part of the cloud that made this star. It's just, fortunately, this bright star actually pushed the material away, because otherwise we would have never seen this star. right? Because all the dense material sitting around it would actually block all the light, but never find it. And so all this emission here, I love this one because it's, I guess we're down here and I live here. It's the California Nebula. So there's many examples, of course, that we can learn from by looking nearby, in testing, you know, all the numerical techniques we're using and sort of get a reality check. Same thing with the supernovae remnants. That's a beautiful picture of Cassay in the X-rays. So very high energy radiation. This is more UV and optical image. You see, you can only sort of see the type of outer shells, but in the X-rays, you see all the hot gas in it, and there's sort of structure on all scales. Now I guess I got really excited early on, so there's fun things about black holes, but we just skip those perhaps and just sort of talk a little bit briefly about these massive stars. I mean, you know, you have to understand if what's amazing about the simulations is they tell you that the first thing in the universe are very massive stars of order between 30 to 300 solar masses. We don't know the exact mass, and that's just an error bar we have from our modeling. But the remarkable thing is that this is perfectly consistent with observations in the sense that we've never found a star that is only made of hydrogen and helium. We've only found stars that have carbon and oxygen in it. And so the thing is, I don't have a free knob. So all we could argue if we wanted to avoid this result is say, oh, you know, that's rare, that's only the very, very first stars, and there's another generation of stars that form differently. But I mean, we're just very encouraged that, you know, I would really not have known what to do if somebody tells me, no, wait a second, you have to make sure all of them only make 10 solar mass stars because observations tell you that. Currently, we would not know how to do that. But you know, their implications is they're not around today because they only live 3 million years, they do their rock star thing, and it's consistent with all the current observational data we have. But now it gets exciting because once you made one, you can just keep going, right? And so when we know how to make one and we see how they act back, I now can start doing galaxies one star at a time. Here's sort of a movie in a temperature map where every single flash that you see is one of these stars. And we're building up a dwarf galaxy down here that had tens of these early stars inside of them. And it's sort of the more pretty version will turn out looking like this. Now, the way you want to think, you know, what's instructive here is, no, this is completely self-consistent calculation, where we actually follow the star all the way down, and then we say, oh, that's where it forms. Then we put in the, you know, we have to assume the mass. We can't perfectly do that. But then we follow the whole evolution, how the radiation gets out, and then just keep computing until the next star forms. And so what's instructive here is the timing. It's like fireworks. It's cosmic fireworks going on. Compared to the rest of the universe, these stars live very quickly. So, you know, it gives you this impression that it's really just flashing in between. And so their supernovae blow out all this material. And in fact, you know, that's a nice thing on the computer. We can track this of now in color is where these heavy elements are. So that's the material that was inside the supernovae that's sort of spreading over, you know, about 20,000 light years across here. And so when you think of our own galaxy 12 billion years ago, you want to think of, you know, about 100,000 of these patches. 100,000 times of these sort of in 3D, so, you know, well, imagine about 50 over this way, 50 back, 50 up. That's more or less what we believe today is what the galaxy looked like just 12 billion years ago, all in these small structures. And so when we then zoom in onto one particular object and just spin it around a little bit, you sort of see, again, in this blue is hot, red is cold. You see some regions that only had one star. This one had multiple in it. It's of all the structures of the filamentary nature of how gas sticks out of these galaxies and how gas from the outset accretes into it along these sort of more filamentary structures is what we can model already today. The pity is, of course, these are still small galaxies. And they're a bit too small yet for current telescopes to see it. But we're already well on the way. There's sort of a point like to make, and I think that David also appreciates, is that there is a nice chance of actually really predicting something where you absolutely had zero information beforehand. And that's sort of why we're so eager to do in the next few years, five, for some things we have 5 years, for other things we still have 10 years time to actually make our prediction. But we can, you know, we're making them as detailed as we possibly can, because, you know, we hope that eventually the telescopes will just prove us right. Now, when, you know, a few years ago, sort of they put one of our simulations on the cover of National Geographic, and they called it "Discovering the First Galaxies." It was bizarre in the sense that they've never had a computer-generated image on their cover. It was always a photograph, and before that, it used to be just drawings, right? Just illustrations when they didn't have photographs yet. And so, you know, it was a big honor for that part. But discovering the first galaxy, so at first, felt too strong a word. But now I actually feel more comfortable that, in fact, there is this area in the cosmos where things nearby to us in time we can study directly with telescopes. Things that happen in the very early phases in the universe, we use big particle colliders and, you know, get to the highest energies that we can probe on Earth. But there's this whole area in between where the only way to discover anything is sort of through these computer simulations. So, you know, I don't want to overstretch this too much, but, you know, since there's sort of a big link in between, I think it is actually quite sensible to use the only tool you have to make progress there. All right, let me wrap up a little bit by wrapping this all together and sort of taking this a little bit personal. So first of all, I tell this my students, much of you is 13.7 billion years old. That's usually when they have sort of simple excuses that, no, you're all mature. Practically nothing of you, of course, is younger than 4.5 billion years. Sort of any atoms in your body were around already at the time the sun and the earth formed. Now, I'm very conservative being recorded. Actually, in reality, I think it's somewhere between 10 to 100 million stars contributed in making every single one of us. So if you go, you know, you take all the atoms in your body and you sort of sort it out by asking, okay, which star were you part of in the past, you would have to get about 100 million different categories, you know, clubs, if you want, alumni clubs, where they could get together. And all of us actually sample some of this. Now, and about, we already said this, sort of about amount of one of your fingers or so came from these very early stars contributed. And all the other generations that come in between help contributing the rest. But one of the shocking parts is if you're very body conscious, sort of Southern California, you used to be almost 1 million light years across, okay? So, you know, any size, you're already much, much smaller than you used to be. I just sort of keep that thing here because actually sort of one, you know, while you're on sort of a philosophical detour, when you think about it and you talk to our biological sciences friends, and they tell us that actually we're constantly cycling our atoms through our body. That in fact, you know, hardly any one of the atoms that it's in my body today, I had as a baby, of course. And you're constantly going through this. Then the picture of, you know, I have of myself a little bit is more of like a wave, where if you drop a stone in the pond, there, you know, the wiggles go up and down, but the and move outwards, right? But there's no water moving outwards. All the water is doing is moving up and down, but there's information that's constantly sort of traveling without actually any material traveling. And somehow, you know, you can think of your body a little bit the same way, as if these atoms are sort of moving through you while you exist, and you are, you know, stay coherent, you know, as much as you can, but they're actually moving through. Oh, thanks. Ah, you can tell, huh? All right, yeah, that was sort of my philosophical side, but you think of life more as a wave in that sense. So let me just sort of summarize. And so, you know, the physics of the universe now is explored not only with telescopes, so the traditional way you picture somebody, you know, sitting up on a big mountain. It's the supercomputers that allow us to do numerical experiments. And the nice thing there is I can vary stuff. I can assume that the universe only had hydrogen. I can assume that the first stars only made black holes. And I can gain an intuition on things it's bizarre a human should have intuition for, right? I mean, why would I sort of feel comfortable of arguing what happens if all the stars in the universe would have never formed and only black holes would have formed? But I can gain intuition by doing experiments on the computer, working through the physical laws. And you know, that's really quite something remarkable that's only really possible today on a reasonable scale. These first stars were massive, so when the observations come in, you know, you heard it here first. The cosmologists, in some sense, are predicting the past. we're really telling you what, or hopefully, you know, telling you the correct way of what happens the very first billion years. And you should really do take this all very personal. All right. Thanks so much for your time. Remarkably, no. It's actually what's amazing is like everywhere we look in the universe, the laws that we find in the laboratory seem to work very well there. So a hydrogen atom that sort of emits a given wavelength today, if you look back, it all is perfectly consistent that all the hydrogen atoms, 12, you know, that are 12 billion years old, you know, or sort of lived 12 billion years ago, did exactly the same thing. And so far there is no smoking gun like that. There were some hints and some data that there might be slight changes, but it's still controversial. So it's remarkable. No, we actually see some lensing, and it's mostly gravitational lensing. So light that comes nearby, that's right. There's absolutely no evidence for that. So, you know, all the lensing sort of and, you know, light path changes are either have to do with the overall expansion of the universe or these local mass concentration. In fact, you know, one thing I didn't mention in the map that I kept going on about the baby picture of the universe, you know, with this red and blue spots. Normally, you know, we always say, oh, you know, the red spot, it's like, is sort of where things are hotter, they denser, because that's what you're used to. Because when you pump up the bicycle, you know, you pump things, as you compress gas, it gets warm. You expand it, it gets cold. Well, actually, in reality, the map is the other way around. What happens is the cold spots are the ones that originate from denser regions, and it's because the photons have to climb out the potential well, I mean, climb out of the gravitational attraction of the material that's there, and they end up slightly colder. It's actually the other way around, but that's sort of more an effect, again, of gravity, but it has a direct effect on light, but you know, not of the vacuum. Well, the remarkable thing is that sort of often a question that also comes is, you know, how big the universe really is. I mean, there's a very clear size to the universe we can study. And that's just exactly the distance from which light had the time to get to us. So in some sense, for us, there's a clear edge to the universe. You know, and it used to get bigger and bigger all the time because, you know, as the universe got older, more and more stuff had the chance, more and more light had the chance to get to us. And the big trouble now is with all this acceleration business that the universe is doing, is that it's changed. And now, in fact, the regions from which light can get to us is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And so many of my colleagues started arguing that if you want to fund astronomy, you have to fund it now. That's right. Right. Sounds confusing, right? And so what it is like for every single first star that formed in its region of the universe, as it looked around back then, its observable universe was only a billion light years, in the language of only things where, you know, within a billion light years, light could have gotten to it. That's its edge of the observable universe. But the underlying universe, in fact, is indeed much larger. There is not a real hard edge to it. It's all a perceived edge that's to it. So, in fact, what happens is even, you know, the effect that might make this clear in your mind is even if you had a static universe that's not expanding, but, you know, somehow you just switched on light, it now would take, you know, sort of this light crossing time to get the information to other places. So as you're sort of sitting there and watching is, from the turn on, you start seeing light. And as you wait, you see larger and larger regions contributing to you. So in fact, even completely independent of expansion, you can understand how the universe, the observable universe, the accessible universe, just grows. Because there was stuff out there, it's just the light hadn't made it to you yet, but now it is, as time goes on. We can draw some diagrams together, maybe. Yeah.
How would black hole production and disruption combination change things?
So, in some sense, actually, people were very happy about our findings that these early stars are very massive, because that gave the possibility that when they die, they leave behind more massive black holes than sort of lower mass stars. And they were eager to have bigger black holes because we see black holes at a time when the universe is only 900 billion years old. I'm sorry, 900 million years. That's 1 billion, and a 1 billion solar mass black hole. So 1 billion times the mass of the sun in a black hole already at the time when the universe was 900 million years old. And they argued, look, you know, it's kind of hard to, like, you know, make these black holes this big. And so when they heard about our big early stars, they said, oh, that's great. Because I start out with a bigger one, if I just feed it nicely, I'm going to do much better in sort of making a big one. Now, and you know, I think the trouble, of course, is once we've now learned how to do, to really study the effects of what the star does to its environment, we've started seeing that the, sort of, you know, this is again shells of constant density. The black hole is red. Everybody knows that. No. We just mark it here like this. And so that's the gas distribution. If you assume that the star expelled the material around it, and it's just about to make the black hole. So now as I go and watch what happens as the black hole is formed, you see all the material is just flying away. Because from the time when the star was on, it heated everything up, the gas was flying away. And now we're waiting hundreds of millions of years in this movie, and I just highlighted the densest point in white. Where material from the outside now falls towards it. But this is very tenuous gas. It's sort of very fluffy material. So the black hole's not eating. You know, I have a 2-year-old son, so you worry when they don't eat. And it's kind of like that. In fact, over 100 million years, it eats one solar mass. So if it started at 100 solar masses, okay, it's 101 solar masses. It's a big deal. You know, I want it to be a billion. And so we now keep arguing, look, don't do it like this. I mean, you know, if to understand supermassive black holes will actually work very differently. And I don't want to speculate too much, but. Well, actually, you know, I don't worry so much because, and the argument goes as follows. When we look out and look at where we do see all the brightest black holes that are eating the most, it's at redshift 3. So that's when the universe was 3 billion years old. And so now what our colleagues are telling us is at redshift 6, where the universe was 1 billion years old, so 3 times less time, it's very unusual to see one that's a billion. But, you know, it's actually, they're 1,000 times less abundant, you know, a factor 3, none of the theories, you know, have in there. When it's going to happen that we see them at redshift 10, I think we really sort of start worrying, because then it's a factor of 10 different in time that we had available in assembling them. And then perhaps it really becomes a discriminant between theories. But right now, factor 3, I mean.
Sure.
I would not be an expert on this. I think, if I understand this right, it actually would have very few implications for us, because you would, in fact, be causally disconnected through most of the region. So you can't talk to it. It's kind of, you know, I'm pragmatic that way. German background. Blame it on that.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. So nice thing, the very first stars, as soon as you get going, you'll make carbon and oxygen all the way up to iron. And so, you know, some of your carbon atoms are in fact, you know, 13.6 billion years old. Oh, sorry, I did the math, 13.4.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that bothers me about the gravity interactions in large structures, forget the universe, but just think of the Virgo cluster, the thousands of layers, is that it travels at the speed of light. So it seems to me like there's could be a lot of chaos and non-predictability, because you can get communications in pretty close to them, to helio orbit. The guys further away don't know what's happening.
Right. You think you get into trouble because you communicate only at the speed of light.
Right, that's my problem.
On the other hand, you have to see that inside the Virgo cluster, the galaxies are moving only at 1,000 kilometers a second. Right? So it's not 300,000 kilometers a second that the light does. So it's just, you know, light is still, even on those scales, much, much faster than any of the motions of the rest. So in fact, you know, it's a couple hundred times faster than the actual motion of the galaxy. So before the galaxy moved any significant part, that information has easily traveled across it. It's just really fast.
Sure, you have it.
How did you know? The last 2 months when I was here, we've been now doing much of modeling of magnetic fields in galaxies. And so it's the usual, I mean, in astrophysics, you know, I'm not sure I can get this right. They say magnetic fields is to astrophysics what sex is for psychology. Right? It's like, you know, if you don't quite understand it, it's because of sex. No, it's because of magnetic fields. And so for the longest time, people have argued, oh, that's way too complicated. We can't deal with this. It's, you know, and it is tricky. But that's what's so exciting about our current, you know, computer technology. We have enough power now to actually start attempting this. And there's beautiful effects. And from observations, we already know that magnetic fields contribute as much pressure in our own galaxy as the gas pressure. So in the galaxy, there will be a large effect. We know this actually for the formation of molecular clouds, and that's why it's so wonderful to be here with my colleagues thinking about how star formation works in the galaxy, because we know it matters there. But for the universe as a whole, gravity always wins. It's just because it has no bound. Great.
Thanks.